Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, minnows, migration, and Mars. The problem with monitoring the environmental impact of pulp mill effluent is that you have to kill the very fish you're trying to protect to test for toxic substances. Aquatic biologist Mark Spafford demonstrates a different approach to testing that will save fish and give regulators better information on water quality. And going to Mars, Dr. Andrew Yao of the University of Calgary already has one satellite on its way to the Red Planet. This and another will research why Mars has lost its atmosphere and water. And zoologist Wayne Roberts looks back at the life and research of Dr. William Rowan, the man who discovered why birds migrate. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Without closed-looped systems, pulp mills still have to discharge their effluent into rivers and lakes. Concern over pollution has brought a lot of changes over the last decade to clean up wastewater. Federal fisheries regulations also require pulp mills to monitor the effects of their effluent on water quality, aquatic insects, algae, and fish. But the testing may actually be more harmful to the fish than the water they live in. Mark Spafford is an aquatic biologist who studied fish monitoring as part of his master's thesis. He now works with Alberta Pacific Forest Industries.
There's a new set of regulations that were put out in 1991, I believe, environmental effects monitoring legislation under the Fisheries Act. Pulp mills are required to select two indicator species, so two species of fish from their receiving environment, from the river or lake they discharged into, and use them as their monitoring or indicators of environmental health for the system. And if we studied, the thought was that if we studied these two species intensively, we could extrapolate to the rest of the fisheries community, saying that they must be feeling the same stressors and whatnot. The past three cycling events or three monitoring events that we've had with the federal program have indicated that as far as ALPAC is concerned, that there hasn't been measurable effects on the fish communities and fish populations. One of the drawbacks of the Sentinel Species monitoring program is that you have to conduct sampling and then kill the fish to measure internal organs and organ weights. One of the other problems that we had at the ALPAC site was that basically the fish that we needed to achieve a big enough sample size so that we could do statistics and compare upstream and downstream was in fact the total population of what was there, and it took us a number of days, on the average about 15 to 16 days of intensive electrofishing to collect enough samples or enough fish to have our sample size that we need. And basically, long and short of it is the EEM program, as it sat then, was far more detrimental than any large spill or release that a pulp mill could achieve in this day and age. It's just not possible for the pulp mill to kill that many fish in a hurry, just as the monitoring program could.
You did your master's thesis on sentinel species. What did that actually look at? Is it part of what you're working on now?
In part, yes. And what we did there was I was looking at the question of comparing large fish, such as sucker, pike, walleye, whitefish, to smaller minnow species or forage fish species. These guys are a lot smaller, again, and the thought is that they're less mobile and more locked into their home range, so that a home range for a smaller fish might be 5 kilometers versus a walleye or a sucker, which is 100 to 150 kilometers. And the problem is with these long-ranged species is they can be exposed to mill effluent for a short period of time, or who knows if they're exposed at all. Even though you catch them downstream of the mill, they may have lived their whole life upstream and just for one reason or another been down there after you started collecting fish.
What are the concerns you're looking at now, then, from an industrial point of view, but also as a scientist, of taking this information and data and trying to incorporate it into something better?
Well, from what we've seen, the large fish survey was fairly wasteful, and even with small-bodied fish, you were faced with a lot of different biases. So what we were looking at instead was a community-based approach where you would sample upstream and downstream, and you'd measure all the fish you caught. And you could do it in such a way as to measure them and then release them. We have found that the information that we get is just as valuable as internal information, and we still have the room to release the fish back into the environment so that we're not creating this huge disaster every time we go out and do a monitoring survey. And because of the time we save by not having to do autopsies, we're able to sample more areas, more fish, and do, a little more of a complete study that gives us a real good indicator of what's going on out there.
Now, you just made a presentation down east. What was your presentation about, and what was the message you were trying to get across to people there?
Yes, it was called the Aquatic Toxicity Workshop, and it was held at St. John's, Newfoundland, early in October. Basically, we were looking at comparing the adult fish survey with the non-lethal, more of a population-level monitoring program that we're suggesting.
Are there any other ways that you could take this research you have done and then apply it to other situations or look at different alternatives?
Yes, one of the other alternatives that I was suggesting at that conference was looking at the level of risk to a receiving environment, to a water or an aquatic system, based on all the inputs, not just the individual mill. So whether or not that mill in particular was a environmental champion, or if they were actually less than desired as far as environmental standard, the environment, the receiving environment was tiered or categorized by the level of risk from all the stressors in the system. So if a mill, if I was to take the Alpac mill as an example, and we look at the Athabasca River and we compare all the stressors on the system to what is deemed a moderate, light, or heavy risk, we have shown so far, based on the results from the Federal Fish Aquatic Monitoring Program, that we have seen no effect or very little effect on fish from pulp mill effluents. So that might put some of the performers, such as Alpac, in a position to suggest a different level of monitoring, where we can do more of a maintenance program, where we monitor the system at the mill and a few parameters in the river to make sure there's been no changes, and then we can reduce the amount of effort that's required to monitor the system. The holdback or the caveat on this is that if there's any changes in the mill or any upsets, then they go back into a full-fledged system. Or if the whole system is downgraded by another input that has not yet been monitored.
Now, you're talking about other stressors, but what could those be?
Many things. Different industry, if we add municipalities, we have a series of dry years and there is less water, or if we have an extended winter with longer ice periods that might cause a dissolved oxygen concern in the river, then we may want to go back and just check on the fish to make sure that they are not at risk. What I was proposing was to give up the fish monitoring instead of doing it every 3 years, to do it every six for the systems that were at low risk. Ones at moderate risk would be doing a program every 3 years, and the ones at high risk would be doing something every year and then an intensive program every 3 years.
Actually, in a lot of ways, this reminds me of the old story about how they used to do bird counts. Like, the way they used to do bird counts was to actually shoot the birds. Of course, now you go out and you do a bird count by looking for them. And in this way, too, you're talking about using science to do science differently instead of killing the fish, going out and doing something that's not going to harm them. How would you comment on that in terms of the progress or the change in the way we evaluate and do our science?
It's a good analogy. Because this is old Gothic type basic science, going out, capture the critter, and then do an autopsy and look at all the things that are going on in the critter, in the animal system. So there's a lot of push now to look at community level stuff, where you're actually monitoring how many new ones are coming into the system. What's the age of the fish in this case? At maturity, reproduction-wise, and we can tell some of these things from just external measurements. We go out in spawning time, we can get an idea on the reproductive rates, as well as we can go out after the hatch and count fry, and we can tell also by just looking at the length of the fish, what year they were born, and what the abundance of those fish are. And if we look at a higher level of understanding, we can look at the number and diversity of age class of different species of fish and look at the communities of these fish and see, has there been a change? Some fish you may find are more sensitive, and over time they may disappear. And those fish that are more generalist and can take a little more stress will fill those niches up. So there's still a lot of good information out there with not killing fish that is available and has been tried and true. And in the United States, this type of method has been in place for 20 years. So in some regards, our monitoring program is a bit backward, and it's nice to see it coming around. We're looking forward to next year's work, where we can demonstrate and present some of the findings that we've been able to come up with, and I'm sure that they'll be very comparable with using the lethal method, and also I believe more informative, because we'll be looking at not just two species but the whole community of fish.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
That was aquatic biologist Mark Spafford. He's a member of the Environmental Resources Team at Alberta Pacific Forest Industries. In July, Mark will conduct a pilot study on the Athabasca River north of Fort McMurray using the non-lethal method of monitoring that he's developed. This will look at the effect of oil sands development on fish communities. Coming up, a mission to Mars. Much to everyone's surprise, the magnetic field on Mars is not like that on Earth. As the planet's core has cooled, there are places where the magnetic field is almost negligible, and other spots where it's almost 500 times that on Earth. Astrophysicist Dr. Andrew Yao at the University of Calgary is among those scientists who speculate that this loss of magnetic field has contributed to the loss of Mars' atmosphere and its water. He has designed a thermal plasma analyzer to test this theory, and it's on board the Japanese satellite Nozomi, which is on its way to Mars. And plasma is ionized gas, which is contained in the solar wind.
What we're looking at here is the a picture of the spacecraft while it was in the final assembly stage at ISS in Japan.
How big would that be?
Okay, the spacecraft itself measures 2 meters long by about 3 meters tall. And our instrument, which is mounted on one of the side panels of the spacecraft, is mounted on a 1 meter boom, so that when it's extended and deployed in orbit, it would be sitting at about a meter away from the spacecraft. The sensor itself is actually quite small. It's about the size of a big coffee mug.
So what have we got here?
Okay. Here we're looking at a cartoon, a schematic cartoon of what we believe has been happening over the last 4 billion years in Mars history. In contrast to the Earth, where here on Earth, where the strong internal magnetic field of the planet shields the atmosphere, from the onslaught of energetic particles from the outside world, including, in particular, the solar wind. On Mars, and also on Venus, for that matter, the internal magnetic field is basically non-existent. And as a result, the charged particles from the sun, the so-called solar wind, is able to penetrate all the way deep down into the Mars upper atmosphere. And as a result, the plasma in the solar wind is able to literally drag the particles in the Mars upper atmosphere along and around the flank of the planet. And over time, this results in a significant removal of both neutral particles and charged particles in the Mars upper atmosphere. And we believe that over time, this process is capable of removing the bulk, if not all, of the volatile materials in the Mars atmosphere. And this may be the reason why there's no more water left on Mars planet today. And there's also speculation that water does still exist on Mars. It's just that it's being trapped underground between rocks and so on. And that's one of the things that both the Mars Express mission and the Nozomi mission will be interested in finding out.
Is there a lot of particles that come along that you'd be able to really track them?
Yeah, we believe so. We certainly hope so. There would, of course, be the homegrown particles, charged particles, but also the solar wind plasma, which is charged particles originating from the sun, because they do penetrate deep into the Mars ionosphere, we should be able to see them also. And in fact, indeed, the objective of the TPA instrument is to make observations of both the local plasma of the Mars ionosphere and the plasma from the solar wind, and to study how to measure the energy contents so that we can understand how the energy is transferred from one plasma to the other and how the resulting escape of plasma particles and neutral particles from the Mars planet occurs.
What is the interest in looking for water, looking for life, and checking out the atmosphere at Mars?
It's to kind of satisfy our innate curiosity as to why our neighboring planets, Mars and Venus, are so different from our own planet, given that the three planets originated from roughly the same time and space in the universe, and given that there are a number of evidences that suggest that the three terrestrial planets probably had very similar content and composition, you know, the way back when at the beginning of the history of the solar system. So the idea then is that, you know, if by learning more about our neighboring planets, maybe we'll know something important that we don't yet already know that might be followed on our own planet.
When will this satellite actually get there so you can do the work?
Both the Nozomi satellite and the Mars Express satellite will arrive January 2004, so we are kind of waiting anxiously, you know, for the action to begin.
Dr. Andrew Yao is a professor of astrophysics at the University of Calgary. You can see an animation of how Dr. Yao's thermal plasma analyzer will work on the Nozomi spacecraft. Just check the project's website at www.phys.ucalgary.ca. Next, a step back in time to the 1920s. Why do birds fly south? Finding the answer to that question made William Rowan famous around the world. Born in Europe, William Rowan came to Alberta in 1908, the same year the University of Alberta was founded. In 1920, he was asked to set up a new department of zoology, and there he carried on some of the most remarkable pioneer research in wildlife biology. Wayne Roberts is the present-day curator of the Zoology Museum, that originally was started by Dr. William Rowan.
Well, like many people, he had a boyhood interest in nature, particularly in birds. I think you have to understand that William Rowan was a very gifted person. He was a musician, he was a painter, a sculptor, as well as a scientist. And I think with all the tools, you know, being able to use your mind and look at things through the eyes of both an artist and a scientist, you can do an awful lot with that. His early interest in bird watching became a passion, and birds, of course, were one of his main research organisms throughout his career as a zoologist.
There was a time, though, when he was criticized for spending so much time studying birds. What was that all about?
It had to do with the lack of funding and what sort of science was perceived as being useful, and a harassed administrator informed him that birds weren't science. You know, it was a lack of understanding and foresight on the part of the administrator. He didn't realize, you know, the sorts of things that Dr. Rowan was about to pioneer.
What are some of the things that he was interested in his early years that contributed then to his scientific work later on?
Well, I think one of the things that's probably fascinated bird watchers since the Stone Age is the fact that the birds go away in the fall and they come back in the spring, you know. People would make the observation that birds would go south, you know, before winter came, and they'd come again in the spring. And Dr. Rowan was curious as to what mechanisms were underlying that. I mean, it's a very important aspect of the lives of many birds. You know, they can't spend the winter here. There simply isn't the food for them, and yet the days are so long and there's so much productivity here in the summer. It's a great place to nest and rear their young. So he was interested in the factors behind the phenomenon of bird migration.
So where did he start? What areas did he look at?
Like I mentioned, people, you know, were aware that migration took place, and people had given thought to it before. They thought, well, they go south because it's cold in the winter, but of course Dr. Rowan was astute and observer enough to know that many of the birds left long before it got cold. They left in winters when it didn't get cold, so it wasn't just the cold they were avoiding. People looked at the dearth of food that we have here in the wintertime, and again, the same kind of thinking holds true, that birds go south when there's still lots of food. They have no idea whether it's going to be a harsh winter or a mild winter, but they go south just the same. So he realized that cold itself, while not a pleasant way to spend the winter, wasn't trying to avoid the cold. They would leave when there was plenty of food. He thought there must be some other factor that was more constant than temperature and food availability that caused them to migrate. And that led him to do research on the effects of light, day length, on bird behavior.
What did he do then to test out his theory about light having an effect on the migration patterns of birds?
He had captive birds that were kept in an environment where he controlled the amount of light that was available to them. So in the wintertime, he could artificially increase the day length and then examine the effects of that on the bird's behavior and physiology. One of the things, you know, people notice is that towards spring, birds become restless. Even caged birds that can't migrate often will start flying against the bars of the cage in the spring because it's time to migrate. They don't know where they're going or why, but they just have the urge to do it. And people had made that observation for many years, but he thought that perhaps it was the increasing day length that was causing them to do that. And when he looked at the gonads of the caged birds that were subject to artificially increased day lengths, he found that their gonads were enlarging. The testes of males were becoming larger. The ovaries of females were becoming larger. And he made that link between reproductive state and migration and increasing day length in the spring.
What kind of birds was he using at that time?
He worked with caged juncos, and he also did some other experiments with crows. And with the crows, he was able to get them to fly north at the wrong time of the year by providing them with cues, increasing daylight, that would lead them to believe it was time to go north. Physiologically and behaviorally, they were prepared to go north, even though it was the dead of winter.
So what impact did that work have on the scientific community?
Well, he was a pioneer in the field of photobiology. There's all sorts of research now that goes on looking at the effects of light on the endocrine system of animals and how the function of the endocrine glands affects many of the behaviors and reproductive states of organisms. So he was a pioneer in that field.
Aside from his work on migration of birds, what else is he famous for?
Well, he was very interested in the cyclic phenomena that we see in animal populations in the north. The hare cycle, the lynx cycle, the cycle we see in small mammal populations, in grouse, these sorts of things. And he thought that that was a great conservation problem. And I think perhaps initially his fear was that these things were sort of oscillating out of whack, and it might be desirable to try and control the oscillations so that average populations weren't merely something in between an extremely high population, an extremely low population. But he did start people doing research into the area of cyclic phenomena in animals. And I think what we've learned is that they're part of a natural scheme of order that we have to understand and appreciate. And we shouldn't really try to change it, but we should try to live understanding that that's the way northern populations of animals frequently work.
Well, I'm just looking at this wonderful picture of a chick that he has drawn, and it's an incredible artistry, the way he has drawn everything. What is this a picture of?
That's a picture of Lesser Yellowlegs, or Greater Yellowlegs, Chick. He had a remarkable eye for detail, and he was able to illustrate his own scientific publications because he's a very, very good artist. Not only did he make line drawings, but he did paintings, and he also did sculptures. And he made models of animals that were used for teaching. Sometimes he made them just to sell to tourists. 1955, you may recall, there was a whooping crane stamp. It was designed to promotion of endangered species, and that was one of Rowan's artworks that was on that stamp.
What was his relationship to the University of Alberta?
Well, he was the founder of the zoology department in 1920, and he was the chairman of that department until his retirement in 1956. He founded the museum that we're working in. These collections were sort of formalized in about 1940. He always was a collector of specimens and artifacts for use as an educational tool and for doing scientific research on. And there are things in this museum that you'd have great difficulty collecting today. But he was a great horse trader. He looked around the world and got all sorts of very nice specimens and started the collection that we see now. It's much larger, of course, than it was back in his day. It used to be in a single room, and now it's three floors in this very large facility that was designed especially for a museum. But the existence of the museum itself is owing to Dr. Rowan's efforts.
When you look back at his life, how would you sum him up as a scientist and a person?
Oh, well, he's a very inspirational person. He had a great deal of ability. He's very generous with that as both a researcher and a teacher. He got by with a very small budget in the old days. He didn't use lack of money as an excuse not to do things. He found a low, cost-effective way of getting things done. And he did some great pioneer research on a very limited budget. And of course, he attracted good people to work in the early department, and they've had graduate students that have carried on the fine tradition of zoological research.
Well, thank you very much, Wayne.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I think people often forget about pioneers like Dr. Rowan, and his legacy lives on both in this collection and in the kind of research he's inspired in the people that worked with him and under him.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Wayne Roberts, curator of the Zoology Museum of the University of Alberta. And just a note, there's a wonderful article about the field journals of Dr. Rowan. You'll find it in the autumn 1958 edition of The Beaver. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Check out our website at innovationalberta.ckua.com. You can download past programs or listen to them on Real Audio. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.